It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. My next guest has spent years working to understand the psychology of racism. In 1997, former Spelman College president Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum wrote a book called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race. 20 years later, she's updated the book, and she speaks tonight at the Atlanta History Center. Beverly Daniel Tatum, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Adam.
I first flipped through your book sometime in the mid-2000s when my wife had been assigned to read it as part of her graduate studies in higher ed administration. And I tell that story right now just to underline for the listeners how important, how significant that text has become. It's really sort of the foundational text for understanding contemporary race relations and racial identity, at least for people in education field in particular. I wonder if for people who have not read the book, could you sum up its basic observation, the original book from 1997?
Sure. Well, when I wrote the book in 1997, my goal was to help readers understand what racism is, how it operates in our society, and how it impacts all of us in terms of how we think about ourselves, in terms of our racial identity, and ultimately how understanding racial identity across lines of difference can improve our capacity to connect with one another and ultimately work together to end racism in our society.
And what's different in the book that you've just put out now, the updated edition, 20 years later?
Well, 20 years later, our social context has changed, and I wanted to really reflect on those changes, the demographic changes, the change in our way of talking about race, the focus that many people had, for example, following the election of President Obama on what was referred to as a post-racial society, recognizing that we are not in a post-racial era and that some of the same problems that haunted us in 1997 are still with us in 2017. Yet we have a new generation of young people that has come of age in a context that makes it very difficult for them to even know where to begin in these conversations.
You write also about the significant demographic change that has continued over the last 20 years.
Absolutely. We know that, I often use this statistic. I was born in 1954, and in the 50s, 90% of the U.S. population was white. In 2014, more than half of the school-age population was made up of children of color. That's a dramatic change, and certainly we see continued growth, certainly in the Latinx population, and the fastest growing population in the U.S. is actually the Asian American population, though only 6% currently the fastest growing, largely as a result of immigration.
I wonder if that dramatic demographic change is one of the reasons why we seem as a society to be paying a little bit more attention lately to the concept of white identity and white identity politics, which surely have always been very significant in American life, but they seem to be getting called out more explicitly lately. And I wonder if maybe it's sort of a natural effect of whites gradually slipping out of their position as the clear majority in the United States, that they're going to maybe naturally identify more as a group and want to advocate for themselves as a group.
Well, I do think that the rhetoric around the loss of majority status, the impending loss, it hasn't happened yet, but the shift in the population has raised racial anxieties for some people. I certainly think that the rhetoric among people like Richard Spencer and other white nationalists has certainly been pushing people to think in that direction. I do think it's important to acknowledge that everybody has a racial identity in a race-conscious society. But it is certainly the case that if you grow up, as many white people do, in largely white communities, attending mostly white schools, working in mostly white working settings, you may not be thinking much about the meaning of whiteness, the meaning of your identity relative to the advantages that are built into our society, the benefit of the doubt that white people receive in so many different contexts. The idea of white privilege is the term white privilege has become for many people an uncomfortable one because they feel like, what privilege have I got? But at the same time, if you understand the way racism works, you cannot deny that there are still systematic benefits accrued to people because of their white skin that people of color do not automatically receive.
We're talking to psychologist and former Spelman College president, Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, author of the landmark 1997 book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? She's just updated it for the 21st century, and she'll be speaking tonight at the Atlanta History Center. so many conversations about race, at least conversations about race involving white people, tend to kind of reach an impasse around this idea. White people would say, listen, I don't hate you, person of color, because of the color of your skin. I have a problem with you because of things that have, at least in my opinion, nothing to do with the color of your skin. Certainly, President Trump has articulated that point of view. He will say that I don't have a problem with these black athletes protesting the national anthem because they're black. I have a problem with them protesting the national anthem. Therefore, racism is not related to this particular dispute that we're having. I imagine, Dr. Tatum, that you would say that that's a simplistic view of racism.
Of course, the first thing I want to say is that the athletes are not protesting the anthem. The athletes are protesting racial injustice, particularly around the criminal justice system. That is what prompted Colin Kaepernick's original protest, and I think it's important that we continue to clarify that. That said, I do think that many people think about racism as simply individual attitudes, prejudices, and they don't acknowledge, and certainly in the statements that President Trump has been making, he has not acknowledged the systematic policies and practices that have long been baked into our system, whether we talk about our criminal justice system or we're talking about housing or access to employment or education. One of the things I talk about in my book is that even though we've seen this demographic shift, we also still have persistent residential and school segregation. In fact, today's public schools are more segregated than they were 20 years ago. So the systemic nature of racism really needs to be confronted and talked about. And that's one of the challenges, I think. I think I always appreciate when people say the whole title of my book, and you did, because the
first time, sorry.
No, but the title, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? It's the conversations about race that I think is really the most critical component, because people are uncomfortable talking about it, and you can't solve a problem if you can't talk about it.
I work at the Center for Collaborative Journalism at Mercer University down in Macon, and for the last year we've been working on a reporting project about the resegregation of Macon's public schools, which is really quite dramatic if we look at the numbers as we have done. At a public forum that we had on the subject not too long ago, a white fellow got up and talked about how his decision to put his child into a private school, and he said, listen, we don't have any problem with black people. I want my son to grow up with people who aren't like him. But, you know, what we have a problem with is the lack of discipline and all of the social problems that are present in these public schools. We just wanted our son to go to a school where he wouldn't have to deal with all of that. And so it has nothing to do with us not wanting our son to attend school with black people. It's just about wanting him to attend a good school, a high functional school. And sort of what I wanted to say to him in that moment, and as a journalist and as a sort of a convener of that conversation, it really wasn't my place. And also, I don't know, as a white person, something about saying what I'm about to say makes me a little bit uncomfortable, but it's a safe space. What I wanted to say to him was, listen, you know, black people suffer tremendous social and economic disadvantages in this country. And with those disadvantages come all kinds of social problems that manifest at school. And if you don't want your son to go to school in the presence of those challenges, then that is saying that you don't want your son to attend school with black people. That is the black condition in America. Was that a good response?
Well, I think it certainly is a good response in the sense of challenging the rhetoric. And I think that it is absolutely the case that sometimes people conflate blackness with poverty, and certainly those two things go together. And anytime people are struggling with poverty, there are social issues that accompany that poverty, whether that's kids coming to school without having food to eat or having a reliable place to live at night, or, you know, any number of other social concerns that are associated with poverty. That said, I do think it's important to point out that according to a recent survey, which I discuss in the book, by the Public Religion Research Institute, 75% of white people have entirely white social networks without any minority presence. And this degree of social network homogeneity, I mean, the fact that you don't have any people of color in your social network means you have no conversations with people of color. And that means that the conversation that's happening among many white people is with other white people. And that is kind of an echo chamber in the sense of not really understanding what other people's perspectives are or what their experiences are. And I think young children growing up without multiple perspectives are at risk of not being able to function very effectively in what is an increasingly diverse society.
In our last minute, what's one thing that everyone can do to have more productive conversations about race?
Risk some discomfort. You know, if we expect to be comfortable all the time, we won't be able to have those conversations. But if we understand that if I have this conversation and keep having it, I will build trust with the people I'm talking to. And over time, I'm going to understand their perspective better. They're going to understand mine. And collectively, we can take action. Talk should lead to productive action. It's not talking for talk's sake. It's for making positive change.
That's former Spelman College president Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, author of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? The book that originally came out in 1997 is out in a new updated edition this year, and she's going to speak tonight at the Atlanta History Center at 8 o'clock. Dr. Tatum, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.